Welcome to Playful Beginnings, a podcast about the magic of play therapy for therapists, students, and anyone interested. In our podcast, we'll explore the deeper understanding of play therapy and the skills we use when working with children.
We hope to help you understand the why behind what we do and how it helps kids heal and grow. I'm Dr. Christy Opiola, a working play therapist and university professor in North Carolina.
And I'm Dr. Maggie Parker, a play therapist and professor in Virginia. Hey, Christy.
Hey, Maggie, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. So you had an idea of what you thought we should talk about today, and I was interested in what you wanted to explore.
Yeah, I often get asked about children of different age groups. So I thought it might be helpful for us to talk about our approach from a developmental perspective. So working, you know, with really little kids at like the lower end of our spectrum all the way up to the higher end of the spectrum in play therapy, and how we make subtle adaptions to what we do to make it developmentally responsive. It's a question I get a lot from students, as well as in consultation and other areas. I thought it might be helpful just to kind of share our perspectives on the developmental considerations to play therapy.
Yeah, I definitely get people who ask me or will say in supervision, well, they're older, and so I can't be child-centered anymore.
Yes.
And I really kind of struggle with this. And this is where you and I's like theoretical perspective is really shining through, because we believe that a theory is how you understand people. And so it shouldn't, how you understand people shouldn't change based upon how old they are, but it does change potentially how we engage with kids. And
or even the language we use. Like, I'm going to use different language for very little children than I am for like 8, 9, 10 or tweens that I might not be doing formal play therapy, what we envision the playroom to look like, but my approach or the way I am in session doesn't really change. It's just, I'm changing my language a little bit to match the person I'm working with.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. I think that for me personally, and I think my students and supervisees too, it makes a lot of sense for us from like the 3 to 8. And then I start to get nervous when I get my 9, 10, 11-year-olds in the room, right? And like, you can kind of see the 9-year-olds still want to play and they still want to engage, but it's in a different way, I think, in my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And even in, I just taught a play therapy course. And so I was helping people find kids to work with. And some of them were all, you know, well, most of them were in third grade. And it's like, oh yeah, but they also still engaged so much. So yeah, what are your kind of thoughts?
Well, I think there's two things I often think about, like in the initial consult with parents or with the school, whoever I'm working with, when they're talking about kids is the first thing I think about is the environment we're going to meet in, mm-hmm. right? So I have found, and it's hard to say it's an age group, as much as just looking at it more individually about how kids will engage in the traditional play space. And so I'm very thoughtful about that. Do I need to make some considerations of the materials I have in there? Do I need to kind of expand the toys that I have in the playroom? Or do we need more of like an activity space to meet where they have access to toys if they want toys, but they also have some more manipulative, creative, expressive arts, crafts, sand tray, basketball hoop, right? Like really being thoughtful about that. And then for the really little, so, you know, like that 2 to 3-year-old range, like the playroom can be really too big, too overwhelming. Do I need to make a few adaptations to the space to better meet their needs to be, sometimes our playrooms are too big.
Mm-hmm.
For very little children. So even just kind of, is there a way I can condense the space a little bit for them so that they're more engaged, they have closer proximity to me, that they might need to feel safe, to feel like they can connect and attune with the therapist in the space. And so that's one thing I think about. I also am very conscious of the words I use. I want to use words that kids are going to understand. And so I don't want to use baby language for my older kids. I put baby language in quotes because some of them will say like, this area is for babies, or don't talk to me like a baby. And so I want to be mindful of shifting that a little bit. And then for very little kids, I don't want to use too big of words or too many words, right? Sometimes I shorten my statements to help connect better.
Yeah.
So what about for you?
Well, I find that when I work with little kids, they tend to also like reflect feelings in a way that like, it's like my tone of voice and
matches
sounds.
too.
Yeah. As opposed to necessarily the words, even though like using the words is really important at this age because they're learning them. But sometimes it's going to be like, oh, that felt icky. Like you didn't like that. And that's going to be,
yes,
you know, icky. I'm trying to think of other words that I use. Oh, wow. Wow is a big one. That was actually my brother's first word.
Oh,
wow. And
that's so
everything
cute.
was, it was really cute.
Wow.
Wow. Everything was wow, which I think is such a good reflection of like kids because everything is new and exciting.
Yes. Or overwhelming,
or
right? Like, I mean, wow can mean lots of different
wow.
things depending on the intonation we put on it. Wow can be exciting, but wow can also be like, whoa.
And so I tend to do that, or I find myself doing that a lot when I'm working with the little kids.
Yeah.
The older
You know what else
kids. Oh, yeah, go
I was
ahead.
going to say? Something I learned in a book I read a long time ago, and actually had when I lived in Boston, had the chance to meet this person, but Harvey Karp, Dr. Harvey Karp, he is a pediatrician who wrote The Happiest Baby on the Block and The Happiest Toddler on the Block. And I love something that has always stood out to me when we're working with really little children in the playroom. Dr. Karp talks about speaking in Neanderthal, which sounds kind of crazy, but like really short sentences, lots of inflection. So like, instead of saying, you're so happy, right? You might just go happy with really little kids in the playroom, but it's often made me mindful of how much I can talk. Really, if I'm going to attune and reflect what the kid is doing when I have 2, 2.5 year olds, and sometimes some 3 year olds who have some regression, that's really how they're speaking in the playroom. So if I want to, in a way, mimic or mirror what they're doing, like I have to really get on their level. So I often think with really young kids to think, be a Neanderthal,
That's
right?
great.
Like just bring it down so that they can hear. And I'm always shocked at how they respond more to simplistic language than a lot of fluffy words or things like that, that it can be really helpful in the playroom. But as you were talking, that's what I was thinking about your brother. Like, yeah, Neanderthal.
Yeah. Oh, he'll love that.
Yeah. And I don't say that to be mean. I'm just saying, you know, like sometimes we have to make it simple.
Well, and I find that too when I work with kids, and I have to remind myself when, even like as a parent, adults, and when I teach the class, right? Adults, we tend to explain a lot. And it's like,
yes.
Okay, we go on and on. And I tune out like half the time when people are going through a long explanation. I'm like, And it kind of like we talked about in another podcast, the wah, 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 wah starts to happen. And I glaze over and then I'll come back in a little bit. And I have to remember that if I'm doing this, kids are going to do this. Like, keep your word or your sentences short.
Yes.
Which I did not keep that sentence short as I explained it. But it so often we want to fill space and we don't need to do that.
Well, and I think we really, just like the children we work with, really want to feel heard and understood. And I think sometimes as adults, we think words help us feel more heard and understood. But that's really left into interpretation, right? Like, so if that tunes you out, that's important for me to know. And so if I'm going to be mindful with kids, I find it easiest to start short and sweet, right? And see what their capacity is. Because I do think that's something that changes when kids get older. Not a lot, right? But I can use more words with older kids, or I use more of myself in the relationship when I work with older kids. Like I might explain, oh, I thought you were doing this because, or I thought you felt this way because blah, blah, blah. And
Well,
not to have them change to my viewpoint, but help like explain, especially for those like 9, 10, 11 year olds. And especially when we get into the tween ages where they really feel like they live on a stage anyway, right? By helping them understand or helping them hear my perspective, right? It opens like conversation, it opens components to our relationship and us connecting and attuning together.
And I think what you're doing is being authentic and genuine in those moments. And you're like, okay, this is what is this, you know, like kind of checking in, like, this is what I'm experiencing, which then also models what it's like to be authentic and genuine within the space. I think for teenagers, it's really, or tweens, right? That's a scary thing, to be authentic and genuine in a lot of their social spaces, because there's such, like you said, like they feel like they're on a stage and everyone's looking at them. And then also there's a lot of internal focus that it's like, oh, if I made a face, that means that you don't like me. And so being able to be like, oh, I made a face that reminded me of something, or like, oh, I just bit my lip. I'm really sorry I made a face. To be really open so that they don't interpret it as like, oh, this is something that isn't okay in the space, so I need to tuck it away.
Yes.
Yeah, I find that that is really helpful, especially as they get older. But even when they're little, right? Like if they're little and I'm going to move around to see what they're doing, I'm going to say, I'm choosing to move my chair so I can see what you're doing. So they don't think I'm maybe that I don't trust them or whatever.
And I think even in that idea of moving, I think I've shared this before, but I work with a lot of clients who have experienced interpersonal trauma. So trauma between people. And so I often don't move without permission, right? So if I'm going to move, I'm going to ask first. And I find myself doing that more with older kids. Who are, and young kids too, who have a lot of hyper awareness of proximity, like how close we are together, where I am in space, where they are in space, right? Like a lot of distrust. I'm going to use more of that permission seeking from them to let them know, like, in this relationship, you can let me know it's not okay, which I don't, my experience is kids, no matter what age they are, that's not often true, but especially when kids get into elementary or middle school, right? And they're in a space with adults, they're adults often are the ones in charge or in control of like how kids can be. And so it kind of shares and changes like our relationship because I'm allowing them to give me permission or not permission in the way that I am with them, which is a really different relationship to have, is what I'm trying to say on this monologue.
Well, I think that happens too with little kids. We just came out of a holiday and a lot of times people are like, give grandma a hug. Then they don't want to give grandma a hug, but you're forcing them to give them a hug. And so by being really transparent and being like, I don't know how you phrase it. I'm trying to think how you would phrase it in the room. You know, I'd like to move here. You can decide if that's okay.
Sometimes I'll say something like, I feel really far away from you. Would it be okay if I come closer? But I also know sometimes kids do things away from us because they don't want us to see, or, you know, they need more personal space. And I don't think I shared this on here before, but I was working with a supervisee and she disagreed on this, which I think is awesome. I love when supervisees disagree with me so we can have like robust conversations and really hear different perspectives. And she was saying like, I feel the need to be closer to my clients. And so the supervisee would move around the room with her client. And then after we had this conversation, she came back and she said, you know what I noticed is I had seen this before, but I didn't really put context to it. But the supervisee like handcuffed me somewhere or tied me somewhere. And so after having our conversation, I was thinking, I wonder if this is because I'm not allowing them to have the freedom of moving without me being in like close contact with them. And so she decided to stay put and the client no longer handcuffed her or roped her somewhere. And also the child's play changed, which was just fascinating for us to have a conversation about. So even just sometimes the awareness of what we do in the room and being thoughtful or having conversations of why we do what we do really helps us grow and like think about what our clients need from us. Right? Both from a developmental, but maybe also personal needs or, you know, like a relational need.
When I think that's also why the room is so important, right? Mm-hmm. Like, cause you want to be able to see what they're doing. And so like in this one room where I was having to move, I wasn't moving within like 3 feet of them. Like I was still separate.
You were just shifting.
I was shifting. Like, so I would just kind of move like my chair this way and be like, I'm choosing to move because I couldn't see the art table from where I was. Right.
Yeah.
And there are times too, and I work with students about this because there wasn't a roller chair in the playroom. And so they were sitting on the floor and then moving really close. And I was like, did the child invite you? You know, have they asked you to come in that close? And they're like, no. And I was like, what would it be like if you sat in a chair that rolled so that you could move or like separate from them? And they were like, oh, I don't know. Right. And then you try it and it is different. And I think honoring that space, or I'm not going to join you unless you ask me, feels really respectful to me.
I also think it's important for clinicians to understand different developmental milestones for children, because it just doesn't have to be bigs and littles, right? It doesn't have to be like the older spectrum or the younger spectrum. There are sometimes, you know, developmental age groups that prefer to know they're competent before they share their competence with us in the playroom, right? So like if they're trying to master a toy or draw something in a specific way, they may not want us to see it until it's completed. Right. And they feel like it's the way they want it, instead of us being able to see the whole process of their creation. And this is where I think, as play therapists, it's important for us to understand development in general, but really understand the age groups of who's coming in, how they express themselves, what are some normal milestones that are happening as far as like emotional development, social development, physical development, right? Cognitive development, all of those components. And I hope that's part of training programs or like people's wheelhouses, but I find that that's not always the case. I know you pulled out the book that I think we use as kind of like our guide.
So hopefully by the time this airs, we'll have a website where you can purchase this book from Amazon. This is one of my favorite books, and Christie's also. It's A Therapist's Guide to Child Development, The Extraordinarily Normal Years, edited by Dee Ray. Yeah, she's coming out with a new one.
No, Dr. Percival and Dr. Jane, I think it is, have edited an adolescent. So same title about adolescent development.
Oh yeah, that would be very helpful.
And I also love information from the Gazelle Institute out of Chicago. So there are lots of resources if you're not familiar. I like Gazelle's materials because they're easy for parents, and they have books about different age groups or like specific years. So parents can read about their 4-year-old. And I think it's a great resource for play therapists to have in their waiting space while parents have 45 minutes to sit and chat. Or I think we also have to be attuned to where parents are today, right? And most parents of young children today are from the technology age, right? They're digital natives. So even the idea of creating, you know, short podcast or short series on development, which Dr. Parker and I are working on as well.
That's something we'll do.
Right. That's something we would like to do, so that, you know, you can have parents kind of go to these resources or find resources that talk about development and what's normal for 3-year-olds, what's abnormal for 3-year-olds. And we can be those types of resources for parents, because unfortunately, there's not a lot of places for them to get it. So as a play therapist, it's really helpful to kind of have a really good general understanding of development, but to be able to speak about it with parents so that, how many of your parents are, like, one of the regular questions I get from parents that I consult with is this normal, right? They're just so worried they've done potentially something to screw up their child, or everything they've tried hasn't worked. And so they're confused. They might be feeling a little defeated, right? And so helping them know what's in the normal range, what's out of the normal range, children is, I think, a really important contribution that we can give parents and families and systems.
Yeah. And I also think a lot of times we have unrealistic expectations for a child, right? Like my 3-year-old didn't abide by the limit the first time. I'm like, yeah, that tracks. Like, they're 3. Like, it's going to take a while.
They want to be independent.
So bad. They're their own person. They've got this. Don't try and tell me what to do, or that I can't have milk, or, you know, it's like, I'm going to show you in the ways that I can.
And so, also, we don't want to strip that component of development of them, like learning self-efficacy, learning what their desires are. Mm-hmm. And so,
I often tell parents, you know, you want, what do you hope that your child will be as an adult, right? And it's usually independent, that they think for themselves, that they're, you know, a lot of self-respect and self-esteem. I'm like, so that starts now. And raising independent children also means raising independent toddlers. And that is hard. And it doesn't mean that there's something wrong. It means that you are helping develop their self-efficacy and their voice and their identity. And that's important.
Yeah. And how do we channel it in a way that we don't strip them of those opportunities?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or we don't rob them of opportunities to kind of like have a voice and respond in maybe more socially acceptable ways. Like 3-year-olds can't walk around the world naked, even though many 3-year-olds like to be naked.
They do.
Right. They don't like the restriction of clothes. And society requires us to wear clothes every day.
Yeah.
In public spaces. You can do that in your room.
And you can
do that in the living room.
Right.
But we can't go outside.
When you
naked.
Choose to go outside, you choose to put clothes on. And I think my dog just walked in. I am raising two very strong and independent children. And, you know, we had this conversation too. And I tell parents, right, it's like, if you choose to go over there and have dinner, you choose to put shoes on. And her response, I think she was like 4 at the time, was, well, it's my body, my choice. And I was like, oh yeah, I see that. You know, you really, it's your feet. So you don't want to put shoes on. And if you choose to go outside, you choose to put shoes on. It's cold. So you can choose to stay here and not, you know, not put your shoes on, or you can choose to go and put your shoes on. And we did this for 45 minutes. She didn't go. She was crying and fell asleep in my arms, right? So, which tells me that she was already overstimulated. She was overtired. Probably going over to a friend's house for dinner was not a smart choice for her in that moment, right? And so this was the hill she needed to really stake a claim in. And we just kind of battled it back and forth. And it didn't mean that I didn't get frustrated, right? And I tell parents that, like, it's okay. Because I think they also think that we are these like perfect, calm, patient beings in all aspects of our lives. And I was like, no, I think at one point I had to FaceTime my mother and say, she needs you for a second, because I need to go breathe. Like, she needs a calm space.
Yeah.
So I think that's just an example too of like, yes, I'm letting her have her strong will, and that's important. There are limits. You can't go out in the wintertime without shoes on. And she had a choice over what she did. She didn't like that choice.
Yeah.
But she was choosing. And I think that's a way in which you, like, I try and help parents understand that you can let them have their voice while also putting boundaries on it and without minimizing their voice.
Well, and I think if we relay that into the playroom too with play therapists, right? Like, because I think those show up in play therapy spaces, like power dynamics are part of our play therapy space. And we afford children a lot of freedom in the playroom, but there's still structure to that freedom. It's not a free-for-all that they can behave in any way they want or do whatever they want in the play space. We'll see those same behaviors come out in relationship with us as play therapists, right? Depending on how you view like our role of control or lack of control, right? Sometimes I think that's a hard concept to learn for a play therapist about. It's okay for kids to battle and be disappointed in the play space, right? Or really try to maneuver their power in relationship with you, right? But these are all tests of normal relational connections, and those things happen in the play space about you, them wanting you to make a decision, or, you know, you returning responsibility to them, or really like dictating to you how they want you to behave or be in the play space. Like, don't speak to me at all. My role is not to sit quiet in the playroom. And so like, I'm going to try to maneuver around that and honor the child's desire for me to be kind of quiet, right? And so understanding development really helps us know how to respond in those moments of like, what is actually happening here? Is this a normal developmental consideration that we need to take to be thoughtful of as therapists? Or is this something else happening, maybe more relational components or how they often feel silenced or whatever, right? Development helps us to be thoughtful of those things within the play space so that we can respond and conceptualize the client more accurately than, you know, just kind of rote decisions that we might think we do based on the textbook that we read as students.
One of my favorite examples that you provided was, we're taught to return responsibility and reflect feeling, and this is what we're supposed to do. And you had a little boy that like really didn't like the way the play therapist before him spoke. And then you came in, and at first he was like, all right, you're cool. I like the way you talk, which was funny because it was the same way.
I didn't talk like his old therapist, and I talked just like her because I was this therapist supervisor. So I knew how she spoke in the playroom.
And you were like, yeah. But then he started getting frustrated. And instead of just like going back and over again, and I think for me, I don't know how you feel, but sometimes when things don't go like they said they would in the book, or if I feel a little off kilter, I tend to feel tight in my chest and a little bit in my jaw even. And I'm like trying to maneuver what to say. And instead of just like saying the rote thing, you said, you really don't like the way I'm talking. And I'm talking this way so you know I see you. And I think that's what you said.
So I understand and see you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it changed his perspective. And sometimes they just need to know.
Yeah, he was very sweet. He was like, that's why you talk this way.
That was it?
Know that?
Oh, my goodness.
Tell me. I mean, literally, he exasperately like fell into the chair. I was like, if I would have known that, like, he was really processing like all of this energy he wasted on telling us how much he didn't like the way we spoke. And after I said that, it never came up again. He was like really okay with this different type of language that play therapists speak in the playroom as a way to convey understanding, to convey empathy, to convey that we really treasure and prize the clientele that we get to work with, right? But it was a really good learning experience for me as well about the idea of transparency and helping. Not every kid needs that response, right? But this kid really needed that response. This kid had experiences of really being harmed and manipulated by adults previously in his life. And so he needed greater understanding of like why I was the way I was and why this felt threatening to him is because I was so different than everyone else, right? So by being more transparent, and like helping him understand that. And again, some of this is developmental, right? Mm-hmm. Some of this is personal experience. Those are kind of, I'd like to say every 7-year-old will respond the same way. That's not going to be the case. Each kid is unique. Each kid sees things differently. And remember, our milestones are averages or like best estimates of where kids should be. And so every kid is either on mark, maybe a little ahead, maybe a little behind, being thoughtful of that in the playroom, but really matching how we respond specific mm-hmm. to the kids that we work with.
And I think, thank you for getting us back onto track for development, because I tend to just, you know, my mind, I think about something and it's, I get excited. But I do think there are going to be certain things that a child's developmental age or stage where they're in, I think stage is probably more accurate than age necessarily, mm-hmm. that can help.
Well, we have to think of it as developmental and like age specific. They're different.
Right.
Right. So when we talk about development, it's really the characteristics we're seeing from the child and how we match that, right? Like to aged consideration and like where they are. But no, kids are rarely perfectly chronologically matched to their age. They kind of mix and match all over the place.
Mm-hmm. And I think, like, I don't know if you've seen these kind of patterns, but when we talk about, or when I was talking about when things kind of go off book and I feel mm-hmm. most anxious, I find that with the young ones, it's either like when like limit setting around leaving or entering the playroom, and sometimes around touch, like they, like they're much faster. It seems like they're like little like ping pong balls. That's perfect. And then the older ones tend to be the ones that look at me and are like, this is boring. And I'm like, oh. And those are the, like, where I see differences in that, those developmental stages and how I engage some of those off book moments.
Yeah.
Or I like what creates some of those.
I think we also need to be mindful that 3-year-olds and 9-year-olds have different relational needs,
mm-hmm.
right? And how they relate to people look different based on like their advancing cognitive abilities, based on their understanding of social relationships, and also where they are emotionally. And so those are things that I think we need to take into consideration. So I would be really worried if a 3-year-old walked into the playroom and said they were bored, right? Mm-hmm. And they didn't like a single thing in there. That would be a big red flag for me compared mm-hmm. to a 9-year-old who might say that. And what I'm thinking for a 9-year-old is, these materials might feel, then we might need to enhance the playroom a little bit to match the need of this 9-year-old,
mm-hmm.
right? Or even, is the playroom the right space to work with this 9-year-old? I was talking with a supervisee yesterday. She has a kiddo who wants to play basketball.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sixth grader who loves basketball, right? And the playroom, we're in a school, and so it really doesn't have space for like a basketball hoop on the door. And so they go to the gym, and we've had lots of conversations. The skill set doesn't change. The environment changed a little bit. We have to do some preparatory work to make sure there's not other people in there. There's still confidentiality. But she's using the same encouragement. She's using the same reflection. She's reflecting the client's desire, right? Like to make a layup or do whatever in that space, and or their frustration that things aren't working out the way they want it to, or they thought they could do this or whatever it is, all of those skills stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
The environment is slightly different.
Yeah. I think a lot of times when I'm working with older kids, I'm going to have a lot more like arts and crafts
mm-hmm.
available, more, I don't know.
Manipulatives.
Yeah.
Like hands-on, activity-based
yes.
kind of things.
More structured kind of things that they can use how they choose, but that
yep.
tools that they could make mm-hmm. a birdhouse or a car,
yep.
you know, whatever that they
and
choose.
Sometimes I have to be thoughtful. I worked on a second floor of an old building
oh.
that had hardwood floors. And so I had some of those things in our activity space. And I forgot the people below us could hear us hammering a birdhouse on the floor, right? So it sounded like
Oh.
the ceiling was caving in, right?
That's
So
funny.
also it's a lot that we kind of have to track and be aware of, but like, you know, what is our space like, and are we offering this, and are we considerate like of our neighbors and other staff that we might have to also pay attention to? But yes, like having more manipulatives for those older age groups that want to be creative in a different way, or don't want to use blocks. They actually want to make something that they can keep,
yeah,
or that they can continue to work on session after session. The one thing I would say with manipulatives, it's better to have open-ended manipulatives. Like I tend to not have like model cars, or if something comes with a direction, I don't put the directions,
put the
out
directions
with the
away.
material. I put them away. But one of my clients found my box of directions, because I don't throw them away. I just put them in the box. All of everything that has like directions lives in the same box. So if I need it for any certain reason, I can go back and find it. But they found it. So then they were like trying to match things up in the playroom, which also tells you a little bit more about the kid, their need for order and direction, and maybe difficulty with creativity or something like that. And so all of these things are informative to us, even if our attentions are not there. But if you put the directions with it, they feel like they have to follow directions. And so taking the directions away and leaving it more open-ended allows for more creativity.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I don't know about your experience, I don't usually have these in the playroom, but I'll bring them out with older kids, or like Legos. And it's hard to buy Legos that aren't in a set, that don't have directions. I really do work to have just a bunch of ones that you can make what you choose, as opposed to this is Harry Potter's world. Also, those are like very expensive. So just trying to let them have that freedom. And Home Depot has a bunch of like free kits you can get for kids. And so I just kind of take the pieces out and take the directions out. And then there's paints. I've also found that less, sometimes the older kids will go to the sandbox, but sometimes they want the sand tray.
Yeah.
And so kind of having that. Now, I also understand that not a lot of people have all of this room to do all of these different things. So it can be really hard to transition. You know, if you have a 3-year-old one session and then a 12-year-old next session, and it just kind of takes some pre-planning.
When we were training at North Texas, they had a medicine cabinet on the wall, or like a kitchen cabinet up on the wall. And that's where I've put a lot of my older kids' materials. A, they can typically reach it. And some of the little kids want to get into it, and I just let them know that those materials are not for the play space, right? But for my older kids, I kind of give them a secure space that we can house some things that are really developmentally responsive for them, so that even in, you know, a one office practice, you can kind of meet the different developmental needs that are happening there, or a cabinet that locks, right? And sometimes my always the 5-year-olds. I don't know why. They're very adamant about wanting to open that locked cabinet. They don't
Very
like that they
curious.
can't get into. Yeah, they're very curious, but they also don't like that they're being restricted from something in that moment. And so they're very determined to get into it, but it's locked, right? And the key sits on top, so they don't see it. They don't have access to it. My older kids know that the key's up there, that they can get to it, that this is like a special space for them, which I also think makes the playroom more inclusive for them at that time.
I'm curious. I have heard of people doing this and I haven't done this, and I'm interested in your thoughts about, you know, whether it be like baking together or cooking
Oh.
together without, like, whether it be with a recipe or not. And I'm interested in your thoughts. I know you just like did a training or listened to
Yeah,
someone
I did
on.
do a culinary therapy training and it was excellent. I really enjoyed the training. It was by a professional chef, so it was much more structured than maybe I might be as a therapist. But I do cooking and baking with older clients. I think it's a great time for exploration,
Do you
right?
follow
Like
a recipe?
I do have recipes in there, but they can also go off script and make their own thing. I also have a choice to try it or not try it. Just like
Yeah.
they have a choice to try it or not try it. But I think something we have to be really careful of, right, is food introduces a whole different level of liability and other things. So
Oh,
kind of
yeah.
being mindful about what products we have in there. So I tend to have like simple box types of recipes, but when I work with parents of tweens and teens, it is one of the menu items that they can choose to do their one-on-one time, the you and me time with their kids. And it's a lot about natural consequences. If they choose to follow a recipe and they misread the recipe and they put 2 cups of salt instead of 2 cups of sugar in a recipe, it's disappointing. There's emotions around that, right? Sometimes they displace responsibility. Why didn't you tell me, Mom, I was doing it wrong? You know, like those things might come up, but really, isn't that how we learn?
Well,
Right? Like in opportunities to fail and to succeed. It
and
also
it's
tells us
that
a lot about kids'
responsibility.
thresholds. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Their
Like their
threshold.
thresholds for disappointment, thresholds for frustration. Like it gives us a lot.
Perfectionism.
Yep.
The willing to try again.
Yep. All of those things. And so, and often that's where parents are telling us their kids are struggling and it just shows up in the space where they get to engage with them. But yes, I have done it. Yes, I have some recipes or like, I really like the inexpensive like muffin mixes and stuff. You just need a convection microwave for it to bake because you get in a convection microwave, you can actually put metal products when you turn it to the convection oven. So it's an easy space to be able to do that stuff. One of my supervisees has an easy bake oven, right? And it's just box mixes, but kids, you know, like to do the exploration. Sometimes they mix two things together.
Yeah.
So they mix the chocolate chip cookie dough and the muffin mix together to see what happens when you make the same thing.
And I think they're like, I haven't had the cooking mixes in a room. I very rarely see like older than 9, but they would also make a lot of food in the sand, right? And like water and sand. And so it's still kind of like that tactile thing, I think, is really helpful. And then like, it can be nurturing, it could be relational, it can be mastery. There's so many different ways in which kids can engage with that. But yeah, that's really interesting. And I'll have to think about that if I start seeing kiddos again.
Yeah. And I like to work across the spectrum. I find it really helps kind of keep me mentally agile and engaged. And so I do try lots of different age groups. It is challenging in a single space office to have like the needs for everyone. And sometimes I just bring things in. Like I have a tween right now who is very passionate about crocheting and knitting. And so she wanted to do that in the play space. It's a relaxing, she's really kind of in emotional turmoil time, right? She's kind of all over the place, which is normal developmentally. And it's calming for her. And she talks a lot when we knit. Right.
Yeah.
Because they also start to transition to more conversational. It's not all play, or they don't want to be conversive at all, but play helps them like
Relax.
express themselves in different ways. And so it's really meeting that developmental shift that's happening for our kids. And so we knit together.
Yeah. I had a client who would, we made slime together. They would bring in the supplies that they wanted and I would get supplies. And so we would try different recipes. So it, not cooking, but recipes, right? And so even the way I am engaging, right, with reflection of feeling and meaning and sometimes limit setting, it does feel more conversational the older the child gets because that's where they are developmentally. And so it does feel more of a conversation than sometimes it feels with the younger kids when I'm reflecting or engaging with them, even if like we're reflecting content and I'm, you know, sharing with them. I think it can feel very much conversational with a 3-year-old, but not in the same way that it does with a 12-year-old.
Yes.
And so in that way, it shifts a little bit. And so I think sometimes people, play therapists, or students kind of struggle with understanding, like, it's still child-centered if you're having a conversation like this. If you are maintaining that understanding and belief, you're just meeting them developmentally where they are. It doesn't mean that you are all of a sudden different.
You're not killing them in questions. You're not doing a lot of skill sets. All of a sudden, as kids have more cognitive ability, it's like we lose trust in who they are as humans sometimes, or feel like they need more guidance, or I don't know. I just, in my own belief about kids and what I have seen that they need, right, that may not match what I think they need. I'm also very realistic. If that's not what the family wants, that's okay.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there's wonderful therapists from all different perspectives. If they want something that's more directive, I'm happy to help them find that. That's just not me as a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes we're so worried that we have to adjust ourselves, even if it's not what we believe in.
Yeah.
This is where it's really important to network and know your community and who you trust in the community, you know, to make referrals.
Yeah. Agreed. You know, we've kind of covered broadly kind of how we look at development. Mm-hmm. I think we could probably go way more in depth for each age and what we look at and what we see, especially I think it might be helpful to do some deeper dives into working with pre-adolescents, and we can maybe bring on some of the researchers that have examined that. But I think like kind of a broad overview.
Oh, yeah, can I say ahead. One other thing?
Yeah.
The other thing that I had to like remind myself, because kind of like you, Maggie, when I first started, I really felt comfortable with littles, you know, like the younger age groups, the traditional age groups of play therapy. And then as I got into the tweens and teens, there was a lot of like self-consciousness and discomfort in me.
Which mimics
that's not
where
uncommon,
they are.
Which also mimics where our kids are. So maybe it's more of a reflection of how they're feeling. I'm not sure. But I remember being really insecure about working with that age group. That wasn't an easy population. It wasn't an easy time frame for me either, right? So there might have been some transference, again, all sorts of things happening.
Yeah.
But one thing that was really helpful that a supervisor said to me is, you know, 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds think you're the coolest thing since sliced bread, right? Like, you're just amazing to them. 9 to 14-year-olds don't always think adults are amazing, and they don't always, you know, love being with their therapist. And it's okay to be uncool, right? Like, and just owning that I'm just not really cool, right? It took a lot of, I say that not because I want to dismiss the age group, but I stopped dismissing myself, right?
Yeah.
So like showing up for yourself in those times to just like be honest, I am who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not always cool to this age group, and I'm okay. Yeah, I do know that about myself, right? And so it takes some of the, I say that as a way to help me as a therapist take some of the pressure off.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing thing about not working so hard to be cool or like to fit in or use always the right, I think it's important to know what kids are saying and to stay abreast of where kids are today. So language they're using, understanding what the language is. I'm still trying to understand this new lingo. I don't have to use it. I don't have to like speak it the same way they do. And they also don't like it if
Because then we just sound uncool.
Right. And so, you know, just like understanding that. So take some pressure off yourself that you have to like be so on top of every little thing about general slang or different things. I'm working on this project of helping this organization. So I literally on my desk right here have the whole thing of general slang teens are using right now and what they mean to like older people.
I learned a lot working in the juvenile detention center, and it was very much like I learned a new linguistic kind of understanding. And also, you may not like me and I'm okay with that. And I was often the only adult that was okay with them not liking me, right? And I'm not going to push you. And by even just by being okay with you not liking me and being genuine in that, it fostered a relationship because I wasn't trying and I wasn't grandstanding, right? Yep. I wasn't forcing like quote unquote respect that many of the adults in that space were doing. And so it was really kind of neat how that went. And then I think I also modeled in a way that it's okay if other people don't like you. It's okay if other people say things about you. I'm not like, that doesn't impact me because I know who I am. And
yeah, I think it goes to our congruence, right? Like knowing who you are, knowing I'm not really cool.
I don't,
you know, I'm not the hippest person on the face of this planet, and I don't have to have like all of these extraordinary components to myself to make myself likable or needable, right? That's what we want to teach kids in our space, that they're just who they need to be, right? Like we also have to grant that to ourselves. And I think when you look at working across the developmental lifespan, that's something you just have to know about yourself. What is my wheelhouse? What is not my wheelhouse? You know, like here are my strengths. Here are areas I know are like, you know, tender spots for me. And if I know those things, because I will say those older age groups that we see in play therapy or in activity family, they love to find those, right? They like to see, they're really about understanding relationships and what pushes relationships, what our triggers in relation. They're trying to figure all that out. They're going to practice it with us as play therapists and as counselors. And we have to be able to, you know, like to ebb and flow in those relationships and hold space for that and be like, ooh, I didn't really like that, you know, but I don't not like you any less because you used that. I just want you to know that just didn't feel good to me.
Yeah.
Well, again, it goes back to that idea. It's the way of being, though I might respond differently to different people in my life, right? Like, I might have different expectations for my clients than I do my partner or a best friend or something like that, where I can express things a little differently, or sometimes I feel like they should know it, right? And so it's more hurtful because I think they know it, where my clients, I don't make the assumption they have like this deep understanding of me because I really don't share that side of me with my clients.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know.
Well, this was really, I think this is going to probably be a theme of our episodes, is that we keep talking and talking and talking because I find it really interesting. And it's just different things come up as we talk. But this was really helpful. And I think we'll probably need to do a deep dive later on.
Yeah, I think that would be fun. We also have other ideas, but if you have ideas that you would like us to talk about, we would love for you to share them with us. I believe there's a spot on the website where they can make comments and other stuff, right, Maggie?
You can use, there's comments, and then you can put reviews and like, and I don't know if you can subscribe yet because I'm still understanding Apple Podcasts, but we'll figure it out.
This is new to us, y'all. Hang in.
Yes, we're figuring it out.
Yeah, but we would love to hear what you want us to talk about too or expand on. We have some ideas, but you know, they're interesting to us. They may not be interesting to you. So let us know. And thank you for joining us today.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.